Las Vegas.
It's more than just a city.
It's a feeling.
It's that feeling of excitement when you spot the lights of the Strip out the airplane window.
It's that feeling of awe as you stroll down the boulevard, taking in the sights and sounds.
And it's that feeling of satisfaction knowing that you're in the greatest city in the world.
Over 42 million people from around the world share that feeling every year.
And I'm one of them.
Taking you to the world-famous Vegas Strip and beyond, my name is Jeff, and this is Jeff Does Vegas. Welcome to From the Vault, a special series of episodes of Jeff Does Vegas. Over the 5 years I ran this podcast, from 2019 to 2024, I released over 180 episodes. And along the way, I talked to some very cool Vegas insiders, entertainers, and local experts. I also shared lots of tips and travel advice and explored the fascinating history of the city. I thought it might be fun to take a little trip back in time and reshare some of those episodes. So, whether you're a longtime follower looking for a re-listen, or you're a Vegas fanatic who just happened to stumble across the show, welcome. I hope you'll stick around for this conversation from the vault. There's no question that Las Vegas is the entertainment capital of the world, and through its history has played host to some of the most legendary acts of all time. Some names come to mind instantly, like the Rat Pack, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, and Sammy Davis Jr. There's Mr. Las Vegas himself, Wayne Newton, who's been performing in Sin City since the mid-60s and still headlines today. And of course, there's the King of Rock and Roll, Elvis Presley, who managed to sell out a record 636 shows at the famed International Hotel, which would later become the Las Vegas Hilton. But one performer made his mark on Las Vegas before any of those people, and it seems he seldom receives the credit he's due. That performer is the one and only Liberace. Joining me on this episode of the podcast is Claire White, the Director of Education at the Mob Museum in downtown Las Vegas. Before joining the team at the Mob Museum, Claire spent several years working at the Liberace Museum, also in Las Vegas, where she learned all about the long and storied career of the man known as Mr. Showmanship. Claire and I talked in depth about Liberace's early days and his development as a performer, the lifestyle he lived and the special connection he shared with his fans, his impact on Las Vegas and his legacy in the city, and much more. Please enjoy my conversation with Claire White.
First museum job was at the Liberace Museum. I worked at the Liberace Museum while I was still in college. I started there 2004, 2005, and I worked there for a little less than 5 years. And I mostly grew up in Las Vegas, and so I think more than the average person born in the 80s, I knew a lot about Liberace already, as I think any Las Vegas local would say. And I loved it. I loved the Liberace Museum. I loved the fact that it was just sort of this hidden gem collection that by the time I worked there did not have the visitation that it had had in its early years, but that it was still just sort of chugging along. And I worked there up until the last year before it closed, which is completely coincidentally. I left to go to graduate school to study museum studies. And by the time I'd moved back to Las Vegas, the museum was long closed. And I had an opportunity to join the Mob Museum. And we certainly focus very heavily on organized crime and law enforcement at the Mob Museum. But a huge part of that story is the Las Vegas story. And you can't talk about Las Vegas without talking about entertainment, not only because it's such a big part of our draw for people, but also because the mob was intimately involved with how entertainers were booked and why entertainers were booked and why entertainers were paid as much as they were paid. Liberace is a great example. When he opens the Riviera in 1955, he has the largest paycheck in the city to date, $50,000. And the Riviera is opened by the mob. There's organized crime financing in the Riviera, pretty much the whole run of the hotel. And, you know, that's a mob sort of mentality. They're actually in debt. They're deeply in debt when the Riviera opens, and they still say, let's throw 50,000 at Liberace because we want the best show ever. And the only way to do that is to put a little money up front, and we know we'll make it back. And so it is tangential to our story, but it's been sort of a fun opportunity for me to re-engage with Liberace. And then sort of it's a fun party trick too, to know as much trivia about Liberace as I do.
Let's dive into the life of Liberace. We'll start off at the beginning, which is always a good place to begin. Where and when was Liberace born, and what was his family life like?
So Liberace was born May 16th, 1919 in West Allis, Wisconsin. And a fun fact about Liberace, he was actually born a twin. His identical twin died at birth. And according to family legend, at least, Liberace himself was 13 pounds at birth, which is not only as a woman just terrifying, but also I would say the reason I like to bring up that story is it's something that he had in common with Elvis. And I think it's one of the sort of surprising ways that he bonded with Elvis later in life when the two of them were performing here in Las Vegas. His parents were Salvatore and Francis. Salvatore, his father, was Italian. His mother, Francis, was Polish. And Liberace was the third of four children. His father actually was a musician. So he grew up with music from an early, early age. His dad played the French horn with the John Philip Sousa band, as well as Milwaukee Philharmonic and other concert and theater bands. And his mom actually also played the piano, although I think it was one of those things that, you know, she'd learned it as a girl. And I don't know how often she was out there playing the piano when Liberace and his siblings were growing up.
Now, my understanding is from some of the reading that I've done, he was actually discouraged by his family to go into music.
So, yes, the Liberace family is interesting because I think it's that standard immigrant story. Salvatore loved music, certainly, and he wanted all of his children to learn a musical instrument at a young age, but he knew how hard it was to be a musician. Like, this was not a wealthy family. They were scrounging and scraping for the majority of Liberace's childhood. And I mean, especially as they move into the Great Depression, I mean, Liberace's a teenager in the Great Depression. It is not a time where you suggest to your children that they become musicians. I certainly don't think either of his parents were by any means disappointed. And certainly his success spoke for itself in later years. But I do think that the goal was for the Liberace children to learn music as a useful skill, but not to make careers out of it.
So despite their discouragement to a degree, it really was his parents that got him interested in music.
Definitely. So all of the children learned instruments. George, the oldest, who later would play with Liberace, learned the violin. And then Angie, his older sister, started learning the piano. And I believe she was 3 years older than him. So when she was, you know, 7, 8, he was 4 or 5, sort of mimicking his sister. And that's when the family realized, like, oh, gosh, he's got an ear. Like, he can actually pick up music at a very young age. I hate to use the word like child prodigy or virtuoso because they're very loaded terms. But he certainly was introduced to music very young by his family, and his family realized when he was only 4 or 5 that he had talent.
In his early career, as he started to work professionally, Liberace really did a lot of different things to try to set himself apart from other classical pianists who were working, didn't he?
Yes. I think he just naturally knew how to market himself from the earliest of ages. And a lot of that is definitely personal aptitude, but I do think it was also who he had as mentors. I think his father in a lot of ways, even though in later in life he and his father were not close at all. I know that his father's ability to sort of play in different styles of music influenced Liberace. His first piano teacher, who he had all through his childhood and teen years, Florence Kelly, she sort of helped him early on come up with the ideas of playing snippets of songs and just sort of getting audiences excited, but not giving them the whole version of a song, which he later referred to as his Reader Digest versions of music. And as much as he certainly honed that skill later in life, I mean, that was directly related to feedback and suggestions that he received from his piano teacher when he was a young kid playing in silent movie theaters. And I think that, he realized really early on that he liked music, he liked the piano, he liked the idea of being a musician. But again, I know that his family struggles influenced what he did. I know that he did not want to be a starving artist. If he was going to be a pianist, he was going to be a popular pianist. And he knew that meant trying some things out, playing popular music, being very conversational with his audience. And then certainly later in life, the huge stagecraft and costumes, but that would take a while to build up.
He seemed to focus very highly on wanting to be more of a quote unquote performer rather than a musician. I mean, he focused on the act as much as he focused on the music, the lighting, the staging, the props, and of course the publicity that he created for himself as well. He really wanted to be different.
Definitely. He loved music, but he knew intrinsically that audiences remember an experience, even more so, honestly, than they do talent. And that's just human nature. So, as soon as technology and his budget accounted and allowed for it, he found ways to really up all of those things that you said, his staging, his lighting, his props, his costumes. And it's interesting, I think sometimes what we hear about people and what we know about people doesn't always come from the best of sources. So, for instance, his partner later in life, Scott Thorson, I think there's a lot about what he said about Liberace that we really do have to take with a grain of salt. But he lived with him for years, not only as his partner, but worked as his, did in fact work as his chauffeur, appeared as his chauffeur in stage performances. And he said, Liberace didn't often practice the piano. He did practice all of these other things, but he wasn't getting up every morning and practicing the piano. He wasn't even necessarily playing for fun by that point in his life in the 80s. And again, Scott Thorson is definitely not a source that I take with full integrity or full truthfulness. But I think that certainly gels with what we know about Liberace, that by certainly later in life, he's far more focused on everything else. And a lot of that, I think he also learned on television. He's on television in the 50s. His show drew more than 30 million viewers during syndication. And a lot of what he realizes people want is directly things that he notices when he's on television. So he employs what television scholars call ritualistic domesticity, which is, this idea that you're inviting someone into your home. Certainly it doesn't work with like a sitcom, but it works very well with talk shows, with variety acts. Shows like The View still use it today. And he invites his mother and George. He makes it very clear that his principal violinist and orchestra director is his brother. He talks about the fact that it's his brother. He ends every show the same way. I mean, very similar to children's programming. Instead of singing Barney's song, he's singing I'll Be Seeing You. And he exaggerates everything. He realizes, like, I can't just play the piano. I have to do these flourishes and I have to have this dramatic lighting and I have to, make the angles and the motions look and pop and feel like you're right there next to it. And he takes that, and it's very different when he's in a stadium or a large concert hall, but he takes those same theories and methods and applies them to his stagecraft.
How did the critics receive Liberace when he first started performing and then later on in his career?
Early critiques of Liberace are interesting because, especially if you're looking at his recital debuts and things like that, it sounds like this is a very, very, very talented concert pianist. And it doesn't take very long for his critique to be that he's not a very talented concert pianist, that he's not a legitimate pianist, that all he is just a showman. There's some clear reasons for that. I think as with any more traditional art form, the people who were first critiquing him when he first started and before he starts wearing the costumes and focusing on the jokes and the stage lighting and driving Rolls Royces out onto the stage, which are all things he did, the critics could identify that he did have a musicality, that he did have musical chops. But the piano playing took up a much smaller percentage of his act the longer and longer he was on the stage. And I think in a lot of ways his critiques came out a lot less like critiques and more like either stating the obvious or what I would describe as just, blatant jealousy that Liberace was making hundreds of thousands of dollars and the other concert pianists were not. I he his critics identified that, he didn't take himself seriously, and so they didn't necessarily take him seriously, but he was in on it. He was in on the joke. I don't think it really bothered him. He's often quoted as being the person who sort of familiarized us with the phrase "cried all the way to the bank," and the first time he apparently used it was, in direct response to a critic, and he said, "I read your review, and thank you so much. My brother George and I, we cried all the way to the bank after reading it."
You mention about the character, quote unquote, of Liberace and how he really didn't take himself all that seriously. I was doing some reading into some of the TV appearances that he made throughout his career. And I mean, we're talking about appearing on shows like the original Batman with Adam West and Burt Ward and being on the Monkees and the Muppet Show. And I watched a video of him from the early 80s when he hosted on MTV and he was once the timekeeper at WrestleMania. I mean, again, he kind of almost, he realized people were laughing at him, but he laughed with them and he was in on the joke.
Liberace was the epitome of being in on the joke. He loved it. He loved the attention. He loved the excess. He loved the fact that he could be this guy out there in public wearing, literally eight rings at a time, and a giant diamond encrusted piano shaped watch, and that he could go to, antique sales and everyone would be like, "Oh, it's just Liberace dropping another, 100,000 on antiques." He loved it. He curated his persona so specifically. And the appearances that you mentioned, I mean, oh my gosh, him playing twins on Batman, incredible for anyone who's not seen it, which I would assume is the majority of your listeners and the majority of people in 2023, definitely worth seeing. Muppet Show, another great example. Liberace's concert with the birds on the Muppet Show is some of the weirdest psychedelic fever art in the history of the Muppets, which is truly saying something, because if you've watched some 70s and 80s Muppet shows, I mean, it's weird all the time. And Liberace took it to the next level. He knew that he was a good piano player and could have made a good stand-up comedian, and that other than that, he didn't necessarily have the biggest acting chops. He didn't necessarily, he wasn't the tallest guy in the room. He knew that people had a certain vision of him, and he was fine playing up to that.
I watched a few videos as well of some of his appearances on Carson and Letterman and some of the late night shows. And again, he looked like he was there to have fun, and it just looked so natural, particularly when you compare it to even appearances by celebrities today on those shows. This just seemed like natural, fun conversation between him and the host, and there was always just such good chemistry with him.
I think he was naturally a nice guy, and I'm not a Midwesterner, so I say this only because this is what people tell me about the Midwest, but I think, he did sort of present himself in conversation with people and meeting people, and in when he was not on stage, he presented himself with what, Americans sort of think of as that typical Midwestern, easy to get along with, humble, funny. You go with the flow. You don't take yourself too seriously. And I think, to add an even more complex layer, Liberace is one of those celebrities who was not naturally a huge extrovert. And so putting on that stage persona, I think, insulated and protected him. I think he got bigger and bolder and crazier the longer he did it, because it did protect his personal life and his personal self. It was a little bit of armor. It was pink turkey feather armor.
There's no question that he lived a very lavish lifestyle, and he really did flaunt it with the publicity and what he shared of himself, in that when he would go on a show like Carson, he'd show up wearing a 25 pound sequined suit and giant diamond rings, and he had films of him swimming in the piano shaped swimming pool and riding around in one of his many Rolls Royces. But it's so odd. I feel like if somebody did that today, where they were flaunting their wealth on social media, everybody would hate them. When I watch these videos of Liberace and I see these photos of him, I'm not mad at the guy. In fact, I really kind of love him for it.
Liberace did a wonderful job of bringing people in, and truly it's that idea of capitalism of make everyone think that they can be a part of this. If they be your friend, if they like you, if they follow this lifestyle, everyone can have this too. Liberace was the master at that. And I don't say that cynically. I mean, I think he really was. I think he knew how to make people feel welcome. And he was so generous. And I think that that's something that did help. I think people intrinsically saw, like, yeah, this guy has got seven houses, and one of them's got a piano-shaped pool, and one of them has like a gold-leafed bathtub, but his mom lives with him, and he donates money to animal rescues, and he's got 27 dogs, and almost all of them are rescue dogs, and he's starting a scholarship foundation, and he wasn't stingy, he was certainly boastful, but in a way that made you feel like, well, he's telling us this because he wants us to be in on it. And in fact, The other aspect of it, and I cannot take credit for this, there's a biography that came out like in 2000, Liberace, an American Boy by Darden Asbury Pyron, that looks at Liberace and his legacy, and the title sort of speaks to what it's about. It's this idea that he is truly that first, second generation American immigrant story of success, and you stay a little humble because your parents made it very clear how hard they worked to get there. And yeah, you've got a little bit of that new money, and maybe you don't always make the wisest investing decisions, but you're really just doing it because you have accomplished this American dream that whether it's real or not, we all think it is.
From the reading that I did into his career, my understanding was Liberace had a very special, very close relationship with his fans. And one of the things I read, and hopefully you'll be able to tell me if this is fact or fiction, was that he read and responded to all of his own fan mail.
Liberace definitely read his fan mail, and I would say probably read as much of it as possible. We know he did. We know that he directly read his fan mail, and the reason we know that is a couple reasons. First of all, because he did in fact tailor things over the years to commentary that his fans had said in letters. He would make jokes or design costumes after specific interactions with fans, either in person or in letters. He also did that a lot of times with the media. If the media gave him a hard time about certain costume elements, he would go out of his way to then one up whatever they'd made fun of. So we do, to get back to your question, we certainly, I think, can in good faith believe him that he read all of his fan mail. Was he the only one taking care of his fan correspondence, particularly when he was on television in the 50s and 60s and he was receiving 10,000 letters a week? I don't know. I have a hard time opening the like 20 pieces of mail that come to me every week. So I know Liberace was probably a more prolific man than I, but I don't know how realistic it was that he personally responded to every piece of fan mail. But did he care deeply for his fans? 100%. Did he read his fan mail? 100%. Did he still have pieces of his fan mail in his collection at the Liberace Museum when I worked there? Yes, he did. So those are all, I think, hopefully good indications of at least his good faith effort to have as close and respectful of a relationship with his fans as he could.
I do want to dive a little bit into his personal life, and this is where things were a little bit dicey in the world of Liberace. Mid-1950s, obviously a very different time from today, stories begin to circulate that Liberace was gay. There were questions about his sexuality. He vehemently fought back against these stories, even going as far as launching lawsuits.
He had an incredible ability, for some people to see him as this clean cut, most eligible bachelor, Dirk square jaw kind of guy, while the other half of his audience saw right through it and immediately said, "That's a gay man." I probably the most famous person to say as much is Elton John, who has said many times, like, first time I saw him on television, I knew he was gay, and I knew this is the first gay person, definitively gay person I've ever seen. And I think that's so incredible because it tells us a lot about perspective and about sort of human nature and seeing what we want to see and also seeing like in like the people who could see through him weren't necessarily, it's not necessarily that they themselves were gay, but there's something that they saw, something about the outsider in Liberace that they were able to identify. But he worked so hard at at hiding that and being a bit of a chameleon that, you know, it was not a part of what he wanted to display to people. And certainly part of that was the culture. I think it would be very different. You know, if his family, I know this is a total tangent, but his family had longevity. Like his parents, his siblings lived a long time. If he had not died of AIDS, I think Liberace may have lived well into the 90s, maybe even the early 2000s, because he was 67 when he passed away. And it would be interesting to see, like, how would he have changed if he'd made it into the 90s, if he'd made it until 2000, as celebrities, young and old, started actively coming out regularly in public, in the media, including ones who, like Liberace, had been essentially closeted for decades. But I also know that he was deeply private, and I'm not certain, in the same way that there are to this day celebrities, gay and straight, who do not want you to know who they're married to, do not want you to know when they're having children, do not want you to know their sexuality or their gender identity. I think Liberace might have never been the kind of person who wanted to talk about his personal life. And so in the mid-50s, to get back to your actual question, there's a couple of gossip columnists in the United States, as well as the Daily Mirror in the UK, who call him out. And there's one, the most famous case is in 1956. He sues the Daily Mirror after their columnist, Cassandra, writes that Liberace is the pinnacle of masculine, feminine, and neuter, and says that he is everything that he, she, and it can ever want. She goes on to describe him as a series of adjectives, none specifically sort of pejoratives, but certainly very clear what she's hinting at. She calls him fruit flavored, and he sues the Daily Mirror for libel. He wins. A jury rules in his favor in 59. He's awarded £8,000 in damages, and he sort of uses this as a blueprint to try to tackle similar stories in the US. So the following year in 57, The Confidential, a very, very gossipy gossip rag in the US, publishes a story entitled "Why Liberace's Theme Song Should Be Mad About the Boy." And this is one of a handful of times when American gossip magazines allude to his homosexuality throughout the 50s and all the way into the 80s. I mean, essentially, they never necessarily let up. They just get a little softer about it, so Liberace won't sue them. He sues again in 57. He settles. And the next time he really has to deal with anything very public is in the 80s when Scott Thorson, his former partner and former chauffeur, sues him for palimony after he's both dumped and dismissed by Liberace. and you know, even as late as when he's in court depositions in 84, he still insists that Scott was never his partner. And I think that's, you know, I think that's interesting for a couple reasons. First of all, because, I mean, it's bold. It is very bold of him. It is very different for him to take a libel suit versus in court saying, no, Scott has never been my partner, clearly perjuring himself. I think what's also interesting about it is, you know, this is someone he'd been publicly seen with for many years. So again, there's sort of this element of it kind of causes confusion. It's like, well, why was he living with you? Why do you have this relationship if you're insisting that he's not your partner or was not your partner? And then I think the other element of it too is, you know, by the 80s, even though it is still not easy to come out as a gay man, it's definitely a different climate. Like to present yourself the way Liberace presented himself and still say, nope, my sexuality is no one's business and it's not on the table and I am not gay and I like gay men for friends and I have homosexual friends and I have friends of all walks of life and I'm totally fine with that, but I myself am not gay is I, that's a that is it's a choice. I mean, it sounds so silly, but that is a very firm choice to take that position that late in life and having presented himself the way he had for so many decades.
It's such an interesting paradox to me with Liberace, where you've got this person who lives this lavish, flamboyant lifestyle. They are out there. They are very public. Their persona is that they are connected to their fans. They're sharing their life. But at the same time, as you say, he's also insanely private about what's going on in his personal life.
It is. And, I'm sure that this might be overstating it a bit, but Liberace is a wonderful blueprint in a lot of ways for a celebrity who wants to be over the top, but also wants to have a private life. Because Liberace, I know I already said this, but he went out of his way to create this stage persona that did help to mask who he was. And yes, it exaggerated certain elements of his personality, and I do not mean his sexuality. I mean literally his personality. It certainly exaggerated elements of his personality, but it was always with an eye towards shielding his true person from the spotlight.
From what I had read, he had hid his sexuality right up to the time of his death. And my understanding as well was that he hid his illness up to the time of his death, and the true cause of his death was not revealed or released until after his passing.
Yes. Liberace passed away on February 4th of 1987. What pretty much no one knew outside of a very, very, very tight circle was that he'd been diagnosed with HIV by his personal physician privately in August of 1985. Certainly his team and select family members were aware of his AIDS status. And his AIDS status had been an enduring rumor for a few years before his death. I think what's unfortunate is that his AIDS status was actually a rumor even before he was diagnosed. So, whether people were saying that about him before he even had HIV is a whole nother matter. But it was definitely a rumor that he was aware of. There were some elements of physical decline, and what his team sort of banked on was the fact that one thing Liberace fans knew about Liberace was that he was a chain smoker, a multiple pack a day smoker from his teens, all literally up until his death. And so one of the things that his team really thought would sort of help them hide his AIDS status was the fact that a lot of the things that are, comorbidities with AIDS, such as the pneumonia that did kill Liberace, are things that also happen in later years to people who are chain smokers. Liberace did have emphysema, and because of that, some of the other things that he was battling with, heart failure and heart disease and some of these things, they're all so tied into being a heavy smoker. And his team did think that, that was something that would be easy to sort of blame. Oh, unfortunately it was his smoking. And his personal physician actively tried to stop the coroner in Palm Springs from performing an autopsy. They did not want this information made public. But unfortunately it kind of backfired because the autopsy report explicitly states that his team was trying to hide the actual cause of his death, which, was pneumonia caused by AIDS.
How close up to the end of his life was he performing and making appearances?
Oh my gosh, up until the very end. So he passes away in early February of 87. He performs his final concert at Radio City Music Hall 2 months earlier, November 2nd, 1986. And truly, if it wasn't for the quirk of when in the year this happened, he probably would have been performing even closer to the time of his death. But Liberace loved to take the whole month of December off. He rarely performed in December and very rarely did television appearances even, because he was a devout Catholic. That wasn't just a thing he said. I mean, he truly, truly was a deeply faithful, devout Catholic. And he also loved Christmas. I mean, I don't think he just loved Christmas because of his Catholic faith. I think he loved Christmas because it involved lights and tinsel and rhinestones and all the things that Liberace loved. So he performs at Radio City Music Hall at the beginning of November. He took the whole month of December off. And his final sort of true public appearance was on television, on the Oprah Winfrey Show. The show aired on Christmas Day, but it was a pre-taped episode that had been filmed in late November. So he had had plans to resume touring in the beginning of 1987, and he had to make other arrangements, that wound up being his final public appearance.
Let's talk about Liberace in Las Vegas and the impact that he had on the world of entertainment in Vegas. When did he first come to Las Vegas and start performing there?
Las Vegas and Liberace are sort of there from the beginning. He comes in 1944. The first time he performs is at the Hotel Last Frontier, which is the second hotel and casino built on the Las Vegas Strip. The entertainment director, Maxine Lewis, hires him for $750 a week, which at the time was about double what he'd been making in other venues. He'd been performing, all across the Midwest, both US and Canada, and then in New York particularly. The story is that after his very first performance, Maxine Lewis is watching him in the back, and he does such a wonderful job that she doubled his contract to $1,500 a week. I say the story is because Liberace was all about the creative storytelling and the exaggeration. And I mean, even, oh gosh, even working at the Liberace Museum, I mean, there were things that some of the staff would say, myself included, that I truly believed. And then you'd think about it one day and you'd think, oh God, there's no way this is possible. And I mean, I know the Liberace Foundation, even though the museum is no longer open to the public, the foundation still operates. And I know that actively to this day, the executive director of the foundation and others on the team, sort of have to deal with that Liberace himself kind of exaggerated some of his stories. And then for 20, 30 years, the museum perpetuated some of those exaggerations. And it's tough with Liberace. It's very similar to the mob, actually, because mobsters are terrible about that also. They, like Bugsy Siegel was a huge exaggerator also, so.
The later years in Vegas, you mentioned he was a part of the Riviera and performed there for a very long time. And then, of course, he also, another thing he shared with Elvis was residency at the Hilton.
Yes. So, I almost don't want to do this because I hate when Elvis overshadows Liberace, but I do have to say, from the beginning of Elvis's time in Las Vegas, he sort of, in a lot of ways, mirrors Liberace. And if it was not for Liberace, I think some of the things that happens to Elvis later in his career here in Vegas might not have happened. Just like Liberace, Elvis's first place that he ever performs in Las Vegas is also the Frontier. He performs there in 56. And in fact, the very first time Elvis ever performed, he doesn't do that well. Because it's the 50s and he's still used to teenage audiences, and that is not who's coming to Las Vegas showrooms. And Liberace literally goes to Elvis and says, "Hey, you are clearly talented. You are clearly a talented musician, clearly a talented singer. If you want to perform here, you're gonna have to change your show a little. You can still sing your songs, but you're going to have to make them more appealing to older audiences. These are not teenage girls. And, think about adding costumes. Think about adding a little flash, a little glitz, a little glamour. And by the time Elvis is performing at the Hilton, he's pretty much he marries the shirtless appeal of Tom Jones with the rhinestone appeal of Liberace, and that's what makes Elvis so successful. But back to the more important person, Liberace. Liberace performs, like you said, at the Hotel Las Frontier. He performs at the Riviera. Then he moves to the Caesar's Palace, and he finally finds a permanent home at the Hilton in 72. He is paid at the time an unprecedented $300,000 a week. Remember, this is 72, so that's 72 money. I mean, he could have bought, like, I don't know, six houses a week on that salary. And his shows, they were incredible. He had a fountain show, kind of the precursor to our Bellagio fountains here, which he called Liberace's Dancing Waters. And in the shows, I mean, he would do as many, and every year they differed a little. So, you weren't necessarily seeing this every time, but he would do as many as like nine costume changes. Every show, he drove out multiple cars onto stage, particularly his mirrored Rolls Royce, which he was not allowed to drive around on the streets of Las Vegas because we get sun like 320 days out of the year. And if he drove that mirrored Rolls Royce on the streets, he would have blinded everyone. He used multiple pianos. He would and to facilitate all of this, to facilitate driving out the multiple cars and moving the pianos and doing the costume changes. The other thing that he really revolutionized was the use of video. The use of video montages, the use of videos to bring people into his personal life in a very curated way. But while he was doing these costume changes, he would show, 30-second videos, minute-long videos that showed him at home with his dogs. So you'd get to meet his Shar-Pei wrinkles, or you'd get to see what his gold-plated, gold-leafed bathtub in his Las Vegas home looked like. And that in and of itself was sort of like a nod to fans. Fans loved this ability to not only see him in person, but also see what was going on at home. My favorite of his video sort of montages was he had in the late 70s a video play at the beginning of his concerts where you'd essentially see him getting ready for the show. I mean, it's clearly not really what he did, but he's putting on his cape. His maid is putting his cape on, and he's getting into his Rolls Royce, and he's driving down Paradise to get to the Hilton, and he's pulling up, and like I, you know, it is it's so it makes you want to be his friend. It makes you want to go to his house and be a part of this and meet his greyhounds and do the whole thing.
Let's talk about the house that he had in Las Vegas, because it in and of itself has got quite a story behind it as well.
Yeah, so Liberace's home in Las Vegas, he purchased it in 1974. People are often surprised he didn't have a permanent residence in Las Vegas until then. Part of that is because he did live in primarily in Southern California. His other six homes were in California, and we're not that far from California. And on top of that, these residency shows, the performers live at the property most of the time. Most of the time they are given elaborate semi-permanent suites to live in while they're performing. And so you don't necessarily need to have a home here. And I mean that's true of so many of the performers who performed here. But by the 70s he's very happy at the Hilton. He always loved Las Vegas, truly. He always did. And so he thinks it's time to invest. So he buys the property. It was in a residential neighborhood just across the street from UNLV. The home still exists. It's now an event venue. It's just a few blocks from the strip. It was perfectly located. And he essentially splits his time between there and his home in Palm Springs for the rest of his life. It really does become sort of one of his two primary residences. His mother lives with him here in Las Vegas. She has her own little private wing in his compound. He decks his Las Vegas home out as much as possible. Certainly not unique to him. He loved interior design, but he does. His bathroom is a sight to behold. If any of your listeners have never looked up a picture of Liberace in his Las Vegas bathtub, it's highly recommended.
What would you say is Liberace's biggest impact on the world of Las Vegas entertainment?
Liberace's impact on Las Vegas entertainment was huge. And I mean, it clearly sounds cliche and it clearly sounds like I'm very biased, but it just can't be overstated. Because of how campy he was, how campy and kitschy and how Vegas he was, I think that's one of the reasons we tend to forget him. We tend to forget him because he's not cool like the Rat Pack. He's not cool like Elvis. He's just Liberace. But the thing is his success in Las Vegas predates the Rat Pack. He is regularly performing at the Riviera long before Sinatra is. Sammy Davis Jr. is actually performing kind of simultaneously with Liberace, but not for the same amount of money, not for the same number of audience members. And not only does he sort of predate the Rat Pack, and so if you're gonna, talk about how important the Rat Pack is, you got to look ahead and before. But in terms of Elvis, he paves the way for Elvis as well as many others. His model of a residency starts at Riviera, is solidified at Caesars, and goes into overdrive at the Hilton. And so when we start seeing in the 70s and 80s and all the way into the modern day, people like Elvis, Anne Margaret, Lola Falana, Tom Jones, Wayne Newton moving into the present with, Cher and Celine Dion and Elton John. When you see those people getting residencies where they are making millions of dollars a week in their paychecks, Liberace created that model. He truly did. And he really did help to drive the huge salaries that Las Vegas entertainers received throughout the 60s and 70s and 80s, and again into the present. He also elevated the technical aspects of shows. The stage flying company, Foy, which is an international company, like he's one of the first entertainers here to use their services, and boy, does he use their services. I mean, he's flying around with his cape spread wide so people can see the front and the back, and he elevated the technical aspects of performance and theater here in Las Vegas. Costume changes, you can't look at people like Elton John and Lady Gaga and their costumes and not see Liberace. And I again, like, yes, I sound incredibly biased, but I'm also speaking of people who have confirmed that, yeah, they want to have costumes the way Liberace had costumes.
Hearing you talk about the contributions that he made to Vegas entertainment and the impact that he had on the city and the industry as a whole, it's so weird to me. He's not celebrated the way other performers are. I mean, there's no Liberace tribute show the way there are Rat Pack tribute shows. There aren't Liberace impersonators and characters walking up and down the strip asking for photos and money the way there are Elvis impersonators. How is he honored in the city?
I wish that the city did do a better job of honoring his legacy on a whole, because you are so correct. So when the Liberace Museum was still open, there were a couple of Liberace impersonators and Liberace style entertainers who performed there, and some of them are still in town and do things, but There is not a market for that. Although, as an aside, it is worth noting there's been a number of think pieces in Las Vegas over the last 10 years about how even Elvis impersonators are diminishing in not only number but in influence. Because I'm grew up in Las Vegas, and I guess something about that just engenders having a bunch of weird jobs. I worked at a themed wedding chapel for a while, and I just read an article that them and a couple others in town do like a third of the number of Elvis weddings that they did just when I worked there about 20 years ago. So we, as a whole, don't always do the greatest job of honoring our history, which is just, what I would say in general. Just last month, so just in December of 2022, a segment of one of the roads and sort of the tourist corridor, Karen Avenue, was renamed Liberace Avenue. And I literally just happened last month. I mean, it's so sad. That should have happened years ago. We have a road named for Sinatra. We have a road named for Dean Martin. Why didn't we have a road named for Liberace? The city does, recognize milestone birthdays and anniversaries of his death and things like that. And there have certainly been recent displays of some of his collection on the Strip. There was an exhibition at Resorts World when it just opened of some of his pianos, and then another component of it was his mirrored Rolls Royce and a couple costumes. I know at the Mob Museum, we certainly reference Liberace performing at the Hotel Last Frontier, and especially the grand opening of the Riviera. He's certainly a part of our story there. But, I think there's two reasons why he's been so overshadowed by Elvis and the Rat Pack and others. And I think part of that is the privacy and the questions when he passed. Even for people who have not an inkling of prejudice or fear or problem with his death or his AIDS status or his homosexuality, there is still, when he passed away, there was this cloud. And so I think it was easier to just sort of ignore the burning questions that people had about him. And that meant that he got forgotten maybe a little too quickly after his death. And then I think the other thing is, after his museum closed to the public in 2010, it is really hard to see Liberace in town. You can still see the collection, that there are tours that you can take by private appointment, but it limits the legacy. I think his impact on Las Vegas and on American popular culture would be easier for people to see if they could see his collection more accessibly, and even more so, I think, if we could contextualize it along with these stories of other entertainers and Las Vegas events.
If people want to learn more about Liberace, are there any particular books or websites you recommend? Any videos you think people should go out of their way to watch?
The great thing about Liberace is you can actually hear directly from him about his life. He did publish two autobiographies. The first one in 1973 is a little more serious minded. And then he published a second autobiography a few years later. Both of them are just a great glimpse into how he himself framed his life and his success and his fame, which is fun. The other great thing about Liberace is, if you don't want to read and you just want to listen, you can access so much media related to Liberace online. I'm not kidding when I recommended The Muppet Show earlier. It was a tongue-in-cheek recommendation, but now I'm doubling down as a firm recommendation that you have to watch Liberace on the Muppet Show. There are also, as you mentioned, some great interviews, some great late night interviews. His Oprah interview, the one that would become his last public appearance, is a fun one. I sad, certainly a bittersweet thing to watch if you're a fan, but definitely a good glimpse into the very end of his life. And then as far as other source material, I think I referenced it earlier. Liberace, An American Boy by Darden Asbury Pyron was written in 2000, and it is a wonderful look at his life. It is academic in the sense that it makes some pretty sweeping claims about his legacy and claims about his place in American popular culture, but definitely not a dense read. I mean, even though it's written by an academic and sort of has a very clear history element to it, it's a easy read. It's a light read.
Excellent stuff, Claire. I really hope that this inspires people to maybe go and learn a little bit more about Liberace and find out a bit more about his history in the city. And I also really hope too that maybe he becomes a little bit more top of mind and becomes a little bit more of a fixture in the minds of people when they think of Vegas history and Vegas entertainment history specifically.
Well, I'm glad I sold you on that, because I do too. I mean, I care deeply about Liberace's legacy, and I know I'm not the only one. The Liberace Foundation still operates. I know they are doing all they can, certainly more than I am on a day-to-day basis, trying to get that story out. And so I, you know, that is actually another resource I should mention. You can find them at liberace.org. But good. You know, Liberace was a huge part of Vegas, and to forget about him is a shame.
Claire, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff. Holding my breath and I'm ready to go. I catch you laughing and I'm ready to go. You're holding the match, I get any night. My soul, I dive in and I'm ready to whoa-oh.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.